From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the man who introduced Indian music to the West, Ravi Shankar. At the age of 79, he's written his autobiography. We'll talk about his guru, the rhythmic and spiritual dimensions of his music, and the impact of his music on the Beatles and the counterculture of the 60s. We'll also meet his teenage daughter, Anushka, who performs with him and has been his student since the age of 9. Also, critic Milo Miles tells us about some Cuban music that's not by the Buena Vista Social Club. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Experts from Egypt are joining U.S. investigators to analyze the cockpit voice recorder from Egypt Air Flight 990. They're trying to determine whether Arabic language statements on the tape indicate that a relief pilot may have caused the crash that killed all 217 people on board. After more than 5 hours of deliberation, the jury has not yet reached a verdict in the trial of Sean Allen Berry in the dragging death of James Byrd, Jr. Janet Heimlich reports from Jasper, Texas.
Attorneys finished closing arguments, both appearing satisfied that put on a good case. Berry's the third white man to be tried for killing James Byrd, Jr., a black man who was dragged behind Berry's pickup truck last year. Two other men, Bill King and Russell Brewer, have already been convicted. Prosecutors made the point that it was Berry's truck that dragged Byrd to his death and that Berry drove to the crime scene. But the lawyer for the 24-year-old Berry said he's not to blame. He said, unlike King and Brewer, Berry's not a racist and had no idea the others planned to kill Byrd that night. During deliberations, the jury requested much evidence, such as photographs and maps of the crime scene, and asked that some of Berry's four-hour testimony be read back to them. They also asked for a transcript from an interview with Berry that appeared on the news magazine show 60 Minutes, too. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Jasper, Texas.
Negotiators for the White House and Republican leaders in Congress say they've almost completed agreements on the five remaining spending bills for the current fiscal year. There are still some last-minute disputes and problems, including disagreements over dairy pricing and mining provisions. U.S. law enforcement officials reported today that drug traffic through Cuba has declined over the past year. That news came as the Clinton administration defended its decision not to cite Cuba as a major drug transit country. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Some Republican leaders in Congress have repeatedly charged that the Cuban government is deeply involved in illegal drug trafficking, and they have demanded that the Clinton administration add Cuba to its list of major drug transit countries. But when President Clinton released the 1999 version of that list last week, Cuba was not on it. At a hearing on Capitol Hill today, officials from the Pentagon, the State Department, and the Drug Enforcement Administration explained that drug trafficking through and around Cuba has actually declined over the past year. Detected shipments by air or over water around Cuba this year, one official said, are 60% below the figure reported for last year. But some Republican critics of the administration were not persuaded. Dan Burton of Indiana and others charged that President Clinton left Cuba off his so-called majors list because he's interested in normalizing relations with the government of Fidel Castro. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 49 points to close at 10,883 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Thousands of Greeks marched on the U.S. Embassy in Athens today to protest Friday's visit by President Clinton. The march came on the 26th anniversary of an uprising at the Athens Polytechnic, which was suppressed by a U.S.-supported military junta then ruling Greece. John Syropoulos reports from Athens.
The violence was in the words rather than the deeds of the biggest anti-American rally in recent days. About 10,000 people called U.S. President Clinton a fascist and murderer because he backed the NATO bombing of neighboring Yugoslavia, which killed many civilians. But the motives of the march largely concerned Greek party politics. The overwhelmingly communist marchers portrayed socialist Prime Minister Kostas Tsimitis as a Clinton yes-man, bowing to the new capitalist world order. Greece is not a protectorate, they shouted, and said the bombs that fell on Belgrade bore Tsimitis' signature. The government says protests will be restricted during Mr. Clinton's visit. The Communist Party says it won't heed the restrictions. For NPR News, this is John Seropoulos in Athens.
America's Roman Catholic bishops agreed today on a plan to impose tighter controls on the religious doctrine taught at Catholic colleges and universities. The new rules would require a bishop's permission for a professor to teach theology on any Catholic campus. The rule would give bishops and higher church authorities more control over church teachings. The new rules must be approved by the Vatican before taking effect. Critics say that such rules will limit academic freedom at Catholic institutions and could threaten those that have government funding. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ravi Shankar, popularized the sitar and Indian music in America long before anyone was using the expression world music. In the 60s, his music influenced everything from the Beatles and John Coltrane to commercial jingles. Now nearing 80, Shankar has been performing with his teenage daughter, Anushka, who has been his student since the age of 9. She'll join us later. Ravi Shankar has a new autobiography called Ragamala. Many of his recordings are now being reissued by Angel Records. Here's music from one of them, Improvisations, recorded in 1962, featuring his music for a film by Satyajit Ray. Ravi Shankar started performing at the age of 10 when in 1930 he moved to Paris to perform in his older brother's Indian dance troupe. 5 years later, a virtuoso musician known as Baba joined the group. Baba became Shankar's guru. At the age of 18, Shankar moved back to India to study with him.
Now, in your autobiography, you describe Baba, your guru, as being given to fits of ferocious anger. What would make him angry?
Well, most of the time, he really was not too angry with me because I could pick up very quickly whatever he taught. But he got angry with students who could not pick up. You see, our whole system of teaching is oral tradition. We don't write down our music. Some can write afterwards just to remember so that one doesn't forget. But he was very, very short-tempered person. He would say once, maybe twice, but after that it would be really catastrophe.
So if a student didn't pick up on what he said, what would he do if he got angry?
No, I mean, if the student picked up nicely to his satisfaction, he wouldn't be angry at all. He was such a nice man, such a sweet person, and good disposition. It's only that he got angry when he saw the students not taking music seriously or not practicing enough or whatever he said three times, four times, and even then they could not pick it up. That's what really made him crazy, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about sitar and Indian music. Indian music is built on different principles than Western classical music or jazz, for that matter. There are many different scales, I think, like 72 different scales. For ragas, what are the elements of a scale in Indian music?
Scales are what we call parent scales. We have got 72 of them. These are full octave ones. And out of the 72 emerges thousands and thousands of different ragas. And all these ragas are again have their own, you know, some are pentatonic, some are hexatonic, six notes or seven notes, five notes. And they have different ascending and descending movement. They each have their own motif or by a passage by which you can immediately recognize that particular raga. It has its own sentiment, what we call rasa, the mood. Nine principal moods. Some are very happy, some are very sad, some are very brave, you know, and some are very, very romantic, some are even very, very erotic. It goes on like that. An artist has got the full liberty to stretch the performing time as he likes according to the situation. One can perform a raga for even 3 hours if needed, from very slow to very fast. Or if need be, it can be performed for a little recording of, say, 3-4 minute piece. It all depends. And the difference, main difference, I would say, with the Western music is that we dwell more and give importance much more to the melody and rhythmic patterns. And over all this comes the word improvisation, which, of course, jazz does improvise also. But it should not be mistaken with jazz, because jazz principally keeps some harmonic pattern, uses chords, and theme is the important where they improvise. They do whatever they want, and they come back to the theme. We do almost the same thing, but we have to follow all the severe, very, very disciplined system of the ragas. We have never, you know, we can never go out of a raga which we are performing. So this improvisation is much harder. It needs many, many years of training under the guru, without which we cannot do.
What is a raga exactly?
Oh. Well, the raga, it will take a long time to explain. I can tell you always, I like to explain by saying what a raga is not. A raga is not just a scale. Raga is not just a melody. Raga is not a key. Raga is not even a mode. You know, the modal music, which is very popular in Middle East, in China, Japan. Mm-hmm. It is something very much more deeper. It has got, as I said earlier, it has its own mood. It has its own ascending, descending, and all the technicalities. So it's a, what I like to call a raga, nearest to it is a melody form.
Might you be able to sing for us an example of an Indian scale?
Well, we have got the basic one, like which is very much same like the major scale. I mean, I won't be singing in C, but like the pattern of la 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 la. This is very much like it is the major scale. Then we have the fourth augmented, which is da la 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 la. It is Kalyan. And like that, we have got all these, you know, with flattened second, with flattened seventh or flattened sixth. And it goes on flattened third, and augmented or sharpened fourth. That's how I said we get this, all the possible combinations makes it to 72 parents. We call them parent scales or melas. Out of this emerges the ragas.
I know the concept of rhythm is different in Indian music than it is in Western music. In Western music, you know, there's a time signature, four-quarter time or three-quarter time, and the music is divided into different bars, each bar having, say, three beats or four beats in it. Could you maybe kind of tap out for us a pattern of rhythm in Indian music and compare that to, say, four-quarter time in Western music?
Well, I mean, you see, we can do so many things, like you give straight count four. One, two, three, four. Oh, one, two, three, e. This can be divided one, two, three, 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 four, five, six, seven. I mean, we can subdivide them and play different patterns in them. Then this is the simple thing. I mean, making three out of one. Then you can go on doing it like five or seven or nine, things like that. Like taka taka te, taka taka te. One, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, one. Three, four. Which means counting four again, five against four. You know, these are the things that we teach our children from the beginning. So a master drummer, after years, you can imagine to what height they can go. They can do impossible things. You know, it is like they can clearly show you 15 against 16.
Wow.
Which is only possible perhaps in your computer, but they are like human computers.
I want to get back to your guru for a moment. When did you know it was time to leave your teacher and go off on your own? How does he tell you it's time, or do you know yourself that it's time?
Well, this is something very interesting, really. And for people to understand today, even it is more interesting. It is almost like a father who sees his child grow. According to the old conception, a son is always like a child. Even if the father himself is 80 and son is 60, his feeling and love and way he wants to protect his issue is almost the same as he felt when he was a baby. Same way, the guru has the same tendency, you know. When the student is really very competent and is already started to perform, the guru always has something more in his mind, and he thinks that he can teach him very much more. You know, that is the average tendency. But on the other hand, the old system was different because they started from childhood learning and staying for, you know, many, many years. And most of them really started performing when he had mustache already and around the age of 25 or 30. But now things have changed, you know, because the whole process of teaching is the children, like the average children, they are so much aware of so many things. They can pick up things much faster than they could before, with the help of everything that they are hearing, radio, discs, tapes, etc., and of course computer and all this. It has speeded up so much the mind of young people that it is not what it used to be. But before it was, you know, they followed the natural theory of a fruit being ripened on the tree properly, then only it has a better taste.
How old were you when you left your guru?
Well, I wish I was younger, to tell you the truth. But on the other hand, I'm not sorry because, you know, from the age of 10, I was like being all the time in the atmosphere of music, our music, that is Indian music, and that is instrumental music, song, folk songs, And along with that, being with my brother in the foreign country, I was drowned in this whole world of jazz, classical music, you know, French, then local music, folk music, then in America, country folk, and jazz again, more jazz, musicals. So I was very lucky, you know, it did tremendous thing. It helped me. When I was with Baba, I was very fast in soaking up the spirit, because I had all this before, which is just the other way around mostly, you know. And I could appreciate my own music much more.
My guest is Ravi Shankar. He has a new autobiography called Raga Mala. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ravi Shankar, and he has a new autobiography, which is called Raga Mala. You write about a period in your life, I think it was in the 1940s, possibly the early 1950s, when you were actually considering suicide until you had a spiritual encounter with meeting a great yogi named Tat Baba. Why were you thinking about suicide, and what happened during this encounter with the yogi?
Well, that was a period when I really was in a very difficult position, because I had to support almost 45 people. You know, it was a troupe of dancers and musicians. We were doing some shows, and then things happened. We could not perform, and we could not leave these people. And so I was alone earning money, and it became so difficult, and a lot of unpleasant things. It all came together that I really thought that enough is enough. I don't think I can, you know. And it was a miraculous thing, really. That very day, someone like that walks in my door with just a pretext. He wanted to use the bathroom. You know, one of his disciples came, and that Baba, we call Baba, which means father, with respect to any elderly person, a great yogi or even musician. And so I said, of course, please. And then I saw him. Immediately I felt connected, you know. And he's stayed for a little while and talked with me. He said, don't be foolish, whatever you're thinking, and everything is going to change. And believe me, it did. From that day onward, everything changed. I started getting so many programs. I was, you know, offered big jobs. Not one, many. I had to choose one from them, and things like that.
How do you think he knew what you were thinking? How do you think he knew that you were so depressed?
I wish I could explain you, then I could be he.
That's a good answer. You started playing with Western musicians, and I think really you were the first Indian musician to start playing with Western jazz musicians and rock musicians and classical musicians. Why did you want to do that? Did that relate to the days when you were a boy traveling with your brother's troupe around the world?
As Charlie Chan said to his son, correction. I would like to correct you.
Okay, please.
I didn't start with rock or jazz musician. It was just my great dear friend, whom I miss very much, who is no more, Yehudi Menuhin, Lord Yehudi Menuhin. We got very friendly from the year 1952, and when I came to Europe and started performing, he offered me to play along with him if I could compose a piece for the Bath music festival in England, which he was the director. So that was very successful, and consecutively I did few pieces for him and me again. We cut three albums in those days, known as West Meets East. And then I did many other things later on, of course, and my student George Harrison, who is like my son and a great friend of mine, whom I taught sitar initially, but later on he was so interested, he composed a lot of songs being influenced by our Indian music and Indian spiritual and religious teachings, things like that, the Vedic culture. And a few other, Philip Glass is another person with whom I collaborated and did that record called The Passages.
Mm-hmm.
The Passages. And I have done a lot of experimentations, which I don't like to call fusion or trying to mix Indian music or Western music like a cocktail to make it interesting. But I genuinely, what I wanted to do is have the bass as pure as possible Indian music within the framework of raga and tala, and use non-Indian musician, non-Indian instruments for special sound, for the range, for the volume, for the colors and all that. And I think some of them came out nice. Of course, I was very much criticized also for it.
Criticized in India.
Especially from India and our musicians. But nevertheless, now things have changed, because now they really, after things that I have done 30 years ago, 40 years ago, are being appreciated now, which makes me happy.
Ravi Shankar will be back in the second half of the show. He has a new autobiography called Raga Mala, and many of his recordings are being reissued by Angel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from the Dial Press, publisher of In Our Time, Memoir of a Revolution by Susan Brown Miller, a feminist leader's look back at the people and events central to the movement. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why Ravi Shankar has walked out on some of his audiences. We continue our conversation with Shankar and meet his daughter and student, Anushka Shankar. That's her playing now. Also, Milo Miles reviews some Cuban music that's not by the Buena Vista Social Club. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the world-renowned Indian musician, sitarist Ravi Shankar. He has a new autobiography called Raga Mala. When you were studying with your guru, he told you that music is sacred and should be kept that way when you perform. And he told you that this applies not only to the performer, but also to the atmosphere that he's playing in. In other words, there should be a sense of decorum shown by the audience. And you write in your book that there were times when you didn't feel that kind of sacred sense around the music, when the audience would be drinking or talking too much, or the place
exactly,
was just too messy.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't even play, you'd leave.
Mm-hmm.
So what
so
was it like?
So many times I stopped and I told them I won't play unless they move away all the drinking things and they sit properly and have a platform for me, not just spread a rug on the floor. This was with some Maharajas and aristocrats in India. I always fought with them. But later on, I had to fight with my young friends, whom I loved very much, in the mid-60s onward, the hippies. You know, almost same thing, because George was my student and I was the guru of George. It became like a cult sort of thing, you know. Along with the music, they took me as a guru, yeah. And so what happened that they came to my concert with the same spirit, being stoned absolutely, high on drugs, LSD or whatever, and then shouting, shrieking, and misbehaving, doing all these sort of things that they should not do. So I had to tell them that, look, when you go to listen to Bach or Beethoven or Mozart, do you behave like that? I'm sure they don't go to listen to these people.
No, I was going to point that out, yeah.
First of all. But even if they did, they wouldn't behave like that. So many times I had to walk out with the sitar and I had to explain them, please try to listen with a pure mind because I can assure you that our music has that power that it can make you feel high and you will feel high. But if you are already gone to in so spacey, you know, and what you hear is not the real thing.
No, but you played at the Monterey Pop Festival, you played at Woodstock, and you know, certainly at Woodstock especially, that sense of a kind of respect and sense of, you know, sacredness of music.
Well, I have written about it, and I'm sure I have spoken about that number of times. Monterey was something which I liked because it was still new, fresh. And there was some, in spite of the drugs and everything, when these young girls and boys, they showed these two fingers like that, like a V, and said peace and love, and offered you a flower, there was some innocence, there was some beauty which touched me so much, and that I even could undergo things which I didn't like. But Woodstock was a time which was almost 2-3 years later, and believe me, by then I thought that this thing is not going to live anymore because it was far gone. Music was just an incidental music to them. They were having fun. It was a fun place, picnic party. They were all stoned. It was raining. It was in mud. And as I said in my book, it reminded me of these water buffaloes we see in India who are, you know, they feel very hot and they sit there, it's so dirty, but they enjoy it. So, I mean, that was the thing I felt, but because it was a contractual thing, I couldn't get out of it. Mm-hmm. I had to go through it, but I was very unhappy.
Now, I know that you don't like psychedelic drugs and don't really approve of them. The funny thing is, there was a period in the 60s when if you heard the sitar in America, chances were it had some kind of psychedelic connotation to it. It was in a movie about psychedelic drugs or an advertisement for a place that wanted to have a kind of psychedelic image. How did that make you feel?
Terrible. Because, you see, it became sort of someone, all these great names like Timothy Leary's and Ginsberg's and Alan Watts, and they sort of made it so clear that as if yoga and tantra and Kama Sutra and Siddhartha book and the hole in the head, and everyone in India takes drugs. Without that, you cannot say mantra, you cannot meditate, you cannot even make love. And all that was so bizarre, I tell you, when I went to Haight-Ashbury and saw what is happening. I couldn't believe it, you know, and all in the name of tantra, mantra, yoga, and everything. It got mixed up. And that's why they had to have a sitar twang in whenever they showed an orgy scene or anything like that. And it is to make me so unhappy, I tell you. But I had to go through. What can you do? I mean, this is where I saw for the first time that a country and a set of people who, when it comes, they have no respect for anyone. They can, you know, criticize the president, they can criticize the God now. That was the beginning. So it was difficult for me. Now I'm used to it. It doesn't matter to me. Whatever you do is your business. As long as you do it yourself well, as long as you are happy and you can make others happy, I think that's fine. I have changed quite a lot in my way of appreciation or being angry at something. All that is no more there.
Would you still walk out if you went to perform someplace and felt that the people weren't being...
The only difference that at that time I might have given a lecture or huff, buff and all that, but now I might walk out very slowly without being noticed.
Huh. Well, you'd be noticed if you walked out of your own concert.
Well, I won't make any commotion out of that, honestly.
Right, right. Now, you've been very close to George Harrison. You've described him as being almost like a son, and he's described you as being almost like a father. You met him in 1966, and this was a period when all the Beatles seemed to be searching for some kind of spiritual help. What did you make of the Beatles when you met them? They were in this period of a kind of spiritual search. Did you consider that search to be an authentic search, or did you feel that they were very kind of confused about what they were looking for?
It was exactly what you are saying. They were confused and they were searching. But to tell you the truth, when I met them, I almost didn't know them or know anything about them, because I had just vaguely heard that it's a popular group. And it was in a party that all the four were there. But it was only George that interested me from the very beginning, because of his being so inquisitive and asking me questions about music and relation to the religion and the spiritual aspect of it and the whole thing. And that's how we came close together, and he started having some lessons.
What did you think of the solo he played on Norwegian Wood?
I never heard it before, and it was only much later on my nephew and nieces, they played for me, and I thought it was terrible in the sound that was produced on the sitar. The song was nice. I liked the song very much, but it was a peculiar sound. Even it didn't sound like sitar even. He had little lesson from a person in London who's a student of mine, who is to be in London at that time. And I told him frankly that it's fine, people like it and you are happy, but I didn't find it interesting enough, because the very sound of sitar, it is something which we have developed since last 750 years, and it's same like taking the violin, someone in Africa sings an African song and scratches on a violin, and how would you feel? Because you know what the violin sounds like.
Right.
The sound of violin has immediate effect. So it was the same thing, but he understood. And that's why he wanted to learn.
My guest is Ravi Shankar. He'll be back with his daughter after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ravi Shankar. He has a new autobiography called Ragamala. In the first part of the interview, we talked a little bit about his guru. Now we'll talk about Ravi Shankar's teaching, and we'll meet his student and teenage daughter, Anushka Shankar. She has a CD of music composed by her father. They've been performing together in concert. Anushka, welcome to the conversation. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Anushka, how long have you been studying with your father, and how old were you when you started?
I started learning from him when I was about 9 years old, which wasn't very serious. It was just, you know, how to hold the instrument and scales and things like that. And it wasn't until I was about 12 that I started to get a little more serious about it. And I'm 18 now, so 9 years.
Whose idea was it for you to study with your father? Your idea, his idea, someone else's idea?
It was actually my mom's idea that I start playing, because apparently my dad wanted to wait until I came to him and asked to learn, because he didn't want to force me to play. And my mom's theory was, well, she's young, you know, let's not waste this time that she could be learning with you. And if she wants to stop, she can stop. And if she wants to continue, she can.
Now, I think in India, sitar is considered a man's instrument, and that a woman's place musically is usually as a singer. And I'm wondering if the fact that you were a girl learning sitar seemed unusual to you or to you, Ravi Shankar.
Well, there are a number of girls who are playing and playing very well. But usually what happens, they get married sooner or later, have children, and they either give up or they don't progress much.
Yeah, it's never felt strange to me to be a female musician. I've never, you know, noticed that anyone treated me differently or anything because of it. It's never been a problem, no.
Ravi Shankar, you had described your teacher as having being given to fits of temper if a student didn't learn something by the second time he was told about it. Did you have much of a temper with your daughter? Or Anushka, maybe I should ask you this.
I did have terrible temper. With other students, I was a terror, absolutely. But with her, I didn't have to same way, because she learned a few times. Only what made me angry at times in the initial stages for a couple of years was that I demanded more of practice from her. And that was the only thing which when she could not do a little thing the way I wanted, I knew immediately it is not because that she cannot, but it is just she doesn't work enough. That's all. But ultimately that also, you know, went away. I learned how to be a father and a guru at the same time, which is a very difficult job. And especially being in California and her being a teenager.
No, you know, I think it was really difficult for him to teach me, especially because I started so young.
And it still is.
Yeah, really. But, you know, if he were to ever lose his temper with me, I'd burst out crying, and he wasn't used to that. I'd be sitting there, you know, I'd put down the instrument, I'd run away in tears, and my mom would get mad at him for making me cry. You know, like, he really had to kind of change a lot for me.
Well, as both the father and the teacher, Ravi Shankar, did the father in you want your daughter to have, you know, a kind of good time as a child and then as a teenager, but did the teacher in you want her to stay home and practice all the time?
You said it. Absolutely. That was the thing. It was a difficult thing, but, you know, it took me some time to adjust, and then I started enjoying it.
Now, when you play together in performance, is there any kind of code that you follow on stage? Since Ravi Shankar, you are the father and teacher, and Anushka Shankar, you are the student and daughter.
Well, as far as our performance is concerned, I still play the role of, in a way, partly guru and partly conductor. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Conduct the program, I mean, making shorter or longer, because it is almost, I would say, at least my part, which I play, is almost 95% improvised, you know. And that is the stage which is my daughter is coming into. You know, it takes a number of years to get to that stage. But when she's on her own, which will be very soon, she has already started, in fact, giving short performances. And I think that's the best thing to do, you know, to be on your own. You fly alone and then you take risks, and that's the whole fun and the thrill of our music.
Anushka, you have lived a lot of your life in the United States, mm-hmm. and you've heard a lot of Western music, and you're you know, several decades younger than your father. I'm wondering how you think...
61 years.
61 years difference. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how you think your style of playing compares to his. I mean, you've learned everything, you know, on sitar from him, and yet you've kind of lived in a different world than he lived in when he was your age. So do you think that's reflected in your playing?
It's hard to say right now because, like you said, I haven't gone off on my own yet and kind of developed my own musical personality. I'm still performing with him as his student. I'm assisting him on stage, and I'm still learning with him. So what I play right now is whatever I've been able to learn from him mm-hmm. and what I know from him. So I really couldn't say yet what the differences would be.
What does it mean to assist him on stage?
I'm kind of the second sitar. He's, you know, the principal musician, and whenever he looks at me, I'll play. Somewhere in the middle, I may have a little solo, but he's the main musician.
So you're like the backup musician.
Yeah.
Your father...
Here you must understand very important thing. That's why, you see, the Western mind has difficulty in understanding this part. Here you play music which is composed by a different composer, maybe born hundreds of years ago. And it is the repertoire which is important. It can be great prodigies like Sarah Chang and so many people who are absolutely fabulous, but they are playing something which has been written down for them. And they can be on their own as soon as possible. But with us, that is not only the case. I give a lot of fixed things to Anushka, which she does absolutely fantastically, and she's also giving, you know, solos which I have fixed for her. But as I said earlier, and she told you also, that it now is the time that it is changing gradually. It will take maybe a year or two, and she will be on her own, absolutely. I have given her all the principal basic things, but there's many things I'm teaching continuously, even on the stage, you know. I think I teach you more on the stage than home.
What do you think you teach her on the stage?
Well, let's say it all comes then and there. I don't know even this few seconds before what I'm going to do. And it comes as a new thing, and those things she sort of immediately grasps and sort of records it in her mind. At that time, she doesn't write down anything, but good things, you know, I've made it a practice that she should write down. And that is something which in for future we have to have our music either recorded or computerized or whatever, you know, so that we don't really forget so many things and obsolete, like so much of our tradition has been lost.
Anushka, your father has been a very innovative sitarist in the sense that he understands the tradition and has mastered the traditions, but he has also played sitar in non-traditional settings. Would you see yourself as trying to be a bit of an iconoclast on the instrument, or do you see yourself more as a traditionalist? You might not have an answer to that one yet.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know. What I want to do is play sitar, but I don't really know what I'm going to want to do with that in the future. Maybe in 20 years I want to just be touring with the instrument. Maybe I want to be composing for something. I really don't know. Maybe all of it.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ravi and Anushka Shankar. Ravi Shankar's new autobiography is called Raga Mala. Many of his recordings are being reissued by Angel Records, which also released Anushka's debut recording. Coming up, Milo Miles on Music from Cuba. This is Fresh Air. With a hit CD and a movie about them, Cuba's Buena Vista Social Club has been the biggest foreign music phenomenon to hit the U.S. since Paul Simon's Graceland. Now a flood of albums has followed Buena Vista. Music critic Milo Miles sorts through the stack and picks three Cuban albums for those who want to step outside of the club.
En el sendero de mi vida triste hallé una flor que apenas su perfume delicioso me embriagó. Cuando empezaba a percibir su aroma se esfumó. Así vive mi alma triste y sola, así vive mi amor.
A basic move to understand music from other countries is to go beyond the token stage, where one group of performers, no matter how delightful, represent an entire culture. But from the simple, strong foundation of the Buena Vista Social Club, you can now cruise into an impressive variety of Cuban music, new and old. The easiest follow-up is the collection called Casa de la Trova, which might as well be known as Buena Vista Social Club, the sequel, though it does not have the same players. It does feature a couple of the same songs, no surprise since Trova are the modified and urbanized folk tunes that function as the classic pop of Cuba. In the familiar Buena Vista format, you get veteran local stars with, if anything, even more diverse backing. The performances are just as relaxed and lived in, with delicious down-home soul dripping from them like syrup.
En tu huerto sembré flor de amores y flor de dolor. En tu huerto encontré y en tu huerto sembré la esperanza y flor de venganza. Tu huerto me si aún conservo la flor traicionera, si ella sabe del mal que me acechó, y es para ti, porque cuando tú mueras, voy a poner esa flor.
¿A dónde?
En tu divino pecho.
¿Por qué?
Porque el que a hierro mata, él llegará a su día. El que a hierro también se morirá. Pero tú mataste mi alegría,
Belén, Belén, paz,
y algún día me la pagará.
On a much more jet-set level, but just as off the screen for the Western world, were Los Zafiros, the Sapphires. In the early 1960s, this quintet served as Cuba's teen idols, doo-wop harmonizers, and flashy rock stars all in one. The Los Zafiros retrospective called Bossa Cubana contains perhaps too much of their work. They could be very derivative of Americano styles. But when they hit their own groove, could they deliver? Oh, yes.
Cubanita primorosa, juguetona y deliciosa.
Bossa cubana.
Cuando asome en la mañana su sonrisa de La Habana.
Bossa cubana.
Con su suave movimiento tan ligeros como el viento.
Bossa cubana.
Que me excita y me fascina, que me lleve y me domina. Bossa cubana.
Los Zafiros were dominated by a live hard and die young ethos foreign to most Cuban bands. How else are you going to get faded stars old and sweet enough to join the Buena Vista Social Club? Exactly how a bunch of performers can be hard workers and still throw a wing-ding party is demonstrated by the remarkable two-CD set Estrellas de Areto. In 1979, an African record producer who lived in Paris bankrolled a week's worth of recording sessions in Havana and invited more than 30 of the most celebrated Cuban improvisers to do a lot of easygoing jamming. Strangely enough, the five LPs that resulted were duds in Cuba and pretty much disappeared for 20 years. Now we can hear that that was a shame.
Mm-hmm.
Estrellas de Areto is one of those rare occasions where a large, non-working band comes together and hits the sweet spot right between heavy arrangement and loose blowing. There's some vocal features, but long chains of instrumental interaction are the rule. The standout soloist, as it seems he always is pianist Ruben Gonzalez, the king of the Buena Vista social clubbers. However, the long workouts on Estrellas de Areto are fiercer and more demanding than the Buena Vista pieces. They probe far into the sweet and musky thickets of Cuban rhythm and soul. They are not for tourists.
Milo Miles is music editor at rock.com. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Patty Leswing. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publishers of Walkin' the Dog by Walter Mosley, now in hardcover wherever books are sold. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Pain Free at Your PC by Pete Egoscue, a program of stretches and exercises designed to relieve repetitive stress syndrome. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Recently, Congress voted against ratifying the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Last year, India tested 5 nuclear bombs. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the implications with George Perkovich, author of India's Nuclear Bomb, The Impact on Global Proliferation. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.